From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Vice President Pence comes to Detroit to whip up support for the new North American trade deal, even as automakers nervously eye President Trump's threatened tariffs.
On trade, there is nothing solid right now, and it's really putting a damper on where investments are going to go.
Student robotics teams from around the globe descend on Detroit for the World Robotics Championship.
The difference between our sport and all the other sports is that every single one of our kids can turn pro.
Archiving and preserving artifacts from the Flint water crisis.
Former Mayor Dane Walling was able to collect a section of his lead service line in his refrigerator water filter.
And we'll preview Kalkaska's National Trout Festival. Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Vice President Mike Pence is in Southeast Michigan today to campaign for President Trump and to tout the benefits of the proposed new deal to replace NAFTA. Now, just how much will this new deal, yet to be approved by Congress, actually benefit Michigan's auto industry? Here now is Kristen Jicek. She's Vice President of Industry, Labor, and Economics at the Center for Automotive Research. Kristen, I think we pretty much know the vice president is going to say how great this proposed U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement is. What is your assessment? Is the Michigan auto industry getting a boost with this proposed new deal?
Well, you know, it's hard to tell right now. We're still working through some of the details, and the real changes to this agreement look at what the future supply chain for automobiles looks like and where those investment decisions will be made. And that's, you know, things for electrification, for connectivity, for automation. And there we do see there's a potential for some net positives to the industry and to Michigan. But, you know, there's a lot of moving parts here and a lot of investment that needs to be made in the next decade. So we're trying to get a handle on that.
Now, the latest assessment from the U.S. International Trade Commission, the ITC, says this USMCA would lead to higher auto prices and a decline in sales. Trump trade officials push back on that. They say the USMCA would lead to $34 billion in new auto investment in its first 5 years and 73,000 new jobs. How do we on the ground parse all of this?
Well, you don't. it's complicated. So the ITC has done, you know, economic modeling of the auto provisions in the USMCA, and the U.S. Trade Representative has totaled up all of the investments that automakers tell them that they are going to make as a result of the USMCA. And the result is probably somewhere in between. Our analysis of the immediate effects are that we would see increased prices and lower overall vehicle sales and production. You know, in the $34 billion, there are some investments that are confidential that the automakers have told the U.S. Trade Representative about that haven't been publicly announced and we don't know about. But there's also a bunch that were made public before, and some of those have been announced three or four times, and dating back to 2015 before Donald Trump was the nominee for the Republican presidential candidacy and before we knew that there would be a renegotiated North American Free Trade Agreement.
Yeah, I'm sure people just wonder, like, what assumptions are all of these estimates, being based on and making when they're talking about a net gain? And it is very hard. As you say, there's so many movable parts. I'm sure it's very hard to be absolute.
Well, you know, and there's a lot of pieces that go into making an investment, too. I mean, automakers have to allocate their investment portfolio, their dollars, at the board level. So those sorts of things are made, you know, 2-3 years in advance of us ever hearing about an investment going to take place. And then once that investment is announced, you know, there's negotiations with the state, the local community, in some cases the union are negotiating about where those investments are going to be and what are the conditions for those investments. And we track investment in the auto industry fairly closely. We see that between 2009 and 2017, there was about $16 billion a year in automaker announced investments, that's gone down to less than $8 billion a year in 2017 and 2018. Some of that is due to where we are in the business cycle and where, you know, which products need renewing and which plants need infusions of capital to, you know, modernize the plant, the paint shop or the body shop or something. But some of that has to do with the uncertainty around what are the rules of trade and where should the footprint be located. And so we've seen a real, you know, a real drop-off in investment activity, or at least announced investment activity.
I'm speaking with Kristen Gcheck, Vice President of Industry, Labor, and Economics at the Center for Automotive Research. So the Vice President is in town at the time that the White House is trying to convince Congress to, you know, support this revision to NAFTA. And there's politics. We've got the President coming to Wisconsin. The Vice President's going to attend a Trump campaign rally. So they're looking to woo back those votes again for 2020. At the same time, we've got this issue of tariffs, the Trump tariffs, and reports are saying auto industry is really worried about Trump considering tariffs of up to 25% on imported cars and parts. If he does that, what could that mean for the auto industry?
Well, that's a constant. I liken it to he's put a bullet in the gun. He's put the gun on the table, and he's negotiating with our trading partners saying, if you don't give us the terms of the agreement we'd like, we will shoot you with these 25% tariffs. It is devastating to the auto industry. We see, we'd see about $2,750 higher prices on vehicles, about 1.2 million fewer sales in the U.S. That would result in a net loss of about 370,000 jobs in the United States. And, you know, it's not just that imported vehicles are going to cost more, but imported parts as well. And every vehicle made in the U.S. has some reliance on imported parts. There are provisions in the USMCA that largely protect the parts imports from Canada and Mexico from being hit by those tariffs, but it's another one of those big uncertainties that's out there. So the automakers are supporting the USMCA. They want to get suppliers on board to support it and drive some political support for the Congress to pick up the legislation and move it forward this year. But that's a real tough sell when some of the key constituent groups, like the AFL-CIO, are saying we're not going to support the USMCA in its current form.
You use that word, uncertainty. I think it's a safe bet to say business and uncertainty are not good bedfellows. How is this uncertainty affecting the auto industry's investments and future plans?
Well, it does mean that the auto industry is sort of waiting to find out what the new rules of the game are going to be. Mm. There's a lot of things that go into making those investments. And, you know, USMCA rules are of origin are one of those things. Yeah. And once that gets solidified, there's still, you know, there's still this threat of tariffs. There's still ongoing open negotiations with Japan, with the EU, and maybe if the UK ever consummates Brexit, there would be a negotiation with the post-Brexit UK. And then we have an ongoing trade battle with China as well. So on trade, there is nothing solid right now. And it's really putting a damper on where investments are going to go.
It's circling back to the USMCA. Would there be a net gain in the American auto industry jobs if this is ratified by Congress?
I can't say that for certain just yet. I'm looking through some of the details of those reports that came out last week, as well as doing our own research. I cannot tell you for certain whether it's net positive or negative, but there are some potentials for positive in it that we see, but it all depends on, you know, getting down in the details.
What will you be looking to hear from Vice President Pence as he's in Detroit?
Well, I think, you know, they will tout the benefits of certainty, the benefits of this future string of investment, that specifically the requirements that new parts of the supply chain be localized in the North American market, and say that that's going to help bring back jobs to the U.S. market. The real question, though, I think, is, did they make complying with USMCA rules so expensive that the underlying tariff rate that we would pay for parts and for passenger cars is 2.5%? So if automakers, parts suppliers, and others, folks in the industry see 2.5% is less costly route to complying with USMCA than meeting all the rule of origin, then they might go the 2.5% route. And in so doing, they open themselves up to getting that sourced material from any one of the WTO members. And that could mean fewer jobs and very much lower content here.
Kristen Gcheck with the Center for Automotive Research. Thank you so much for letting us pick your very, very smart brain.
Oh, thank you.
Naloxone is a chemical compound that can stop an opioid overdose. For a long time, it was only used by first responders, law enforcement. But as overdoses increase nationwide, advocates are trying to get it into the hands of as many people as possible. Interlochen Public Radio's Max Johnston was at a community training event.
When someone overdoses, responding quickly could be the difference between life and death. That's why 10 to 12 people are packed into a small room at the Traverse Area District Library. They're here to learn how to use naloxone, sometimes called Narcan. During an overdose, naloxone keeps oxygen going to the victim's brain and flushes out opioids from their system.
But we are going to do some practicing with some expired naloxone, drying it up. So that if you're in the situation where someone's overdosed, it's not your first time doing it, because that can be hectic.
That's Peter Edgley with Harm Reduction Michigan, a nonprofit addiction services agency. Peter has a history with naloxone.
I was a user for about 5 years. I have been revived with naloxone over 20 times, and I brought back about 20 people. So I know a thing or two about how it works.
He hands out overdose rescue kits. Each kit has 3 syringes, a few small bottles of naloxone, and instructions on how to use it. Peter helps a newcomer draw the drug into a syringe.
I have no idea how to open this thing.
Okay. Well, you would draw up what's in one of the jars.
Peter pops the safety top off of a naloxone bottle and sticks a syringe through a small opening in the cap.
You can turn the vials upside down and draw that way. That way you're not trying to figure out the trajectory of how to get the needle to the bottom of the jar.
Then, Peter says, make sure the person is on their side and inject the naloxone into a large muscle. He recommends the thigh. That won't hurt as much as the bicep. After that, administer CPR and be ready with more naloxone. There's 3 doses per kit, and Peter says you may need all of them. He says the first time he used it was when his roommate had just overdosed. The rescue kit said give 1 dose every 2 to 3 minutes.
So that's what I did. And he started breathing again, and I was terrified through the whole experience.
Peter started attending naloxone training shortly after that. He says it helped him kick his addiction.
I found that helping other people was really helpful for me.
You can find more information about naloxone and training events at harmreductionmi.org. I'm Max Johnston.
Thousands of high school students in town for the World Robotics Championship in Detroit. That story after the break. This is Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Some 42,000 people from all over the world have descended on Detroit, and they've brought their robots with them. The first Robotics World Championship has come back to Detroit for a second year. School robotics teams vying for the top prize with robots they've designed and built. Gail Alpert is president of FIRST in Michigan, and she joins us now via Skype. Gail, what does FIRST stand for?
FIRST is an acronym for Inspiration and Recognition of Science and Technology.
And why did this world competition come back to Detroit for a second straight year?
I have no doubt that it's because Michigan is the leader in robotics, especially FIRST robotics. We have the highest number of high school teams in the nation. We have the highest number of junior FLL teams at K-3 level. We are number 5 in late elementary, and we're number 2 in middle school. So we have all 4 programs are flourishing, extremely healthy inside of Michigan.
And I guess they figured out that between Ford Field and Cobo, they're able to handle some 42,000 people.
Yes, when they actually put out the request to see who could handle it, we were one of the only places that could, along with several others, who now, since it's come to Detroit, are looking to do the same thing because they see how successful and how fabulous it is here.
What is it like at a competition? What would people see? Because I know it's wide open to anyone who wants to come watch.
What it looks like is a cross between a rock concert and any athletic sport, varsity athletic sport that you could possibly see. The difference between our sport and all the other sports is that every single one of our kids can turn pro. So it's wild. You come here, there are mascots, there are referees, umpires, there are judges. Everything that you see at a normal sporting event is here on steroids.
And when you say every single one of these kids can turn pro, you're saying what, they're getting skills that will get them a good job?
Yes, there's a job that's waiting for every one of these kids, unlike varsity sports, where only the upper echelon ever make it. Every one of our kids can get a fabulous job.
And so they're certainly, you know, learning to apply these STEM skills that are so important in creating a robot, designing and building, engineering and coding. What else are they learning as they're part of a robotics team?
You know, like any other sport or any other team, they're learning the soft skills too. What's really great about FIRST Robotics is that in high school, the kids have a chance to try on every single STEM career. And they can decide what they want to pursue in life. What do they love? What are they passionate about? We have kids that think they want to do programming, but after they build the robot and they've worked on the mechanical side or the electrical side, they love that instead. Now, on top of that, every single team functions like a small business. So like any business, you have fundraising, you have communications, you have marketing, imagery. You're learning all of that, branding, at a very, very young age in high school.
And I know your mission, first in Michigan, is to get robotics programs into as many school districts as you can. How are you doing in that? How many districts in Michigan have robotics teams now?
Oh, my gosh. We have over 2,200 teams throughout Michigan, and 85 of our school districts have every single level of FIRST represented within their district. That's almost double what we had last year. And we will not stop until every school in Michigan has a team.
And am I right that these robotics programs can actually start as early as preschool?
Well, yes. Actually, this year, for the first time in Ferndale, Ferndale was chosen to pilot a preschool program. Someone says pretty soon we're going to be in utero.
What brought you to FIRST into the world of robotics competitions?
I was introduced to FIRST through my son, who was in high school, and as an elective at the school that he had to do, he chose to be on a FIRST robotics team. And after 6 months, he was so hooked, and all of his friends were hooked, and so I ended up running the team. And from that, I went on to start helping at the state level, and from that, we went on to form our own faction within FIRST.
So when we go back to this big world championship that is going to be happening over the next 4 days in Detroit, so they're going from Cobo, and they're going to be at Ford Field, why are they in the locations? What kind of things are happening that are different at both locations?
So the whole competition is basically at Cobo. If you were to come, you would want to come anytime between now and Saturday at noon to Cobo Hall. That's where we have the competition at every single level, from elementary all the way up, and even our preschool pilot is here. Then at the high school level, we have 8 fields that are running, and every single field will produce a winner of that division. And then they will face off, and then the winners, the final contenders, will be at Ford Field playing their final rounds to see who's ultimately crowned the world champion of FIRST Robotics.
How many countries are represented?
I would say that I don't know the exact number, but I know that we have people from all over, from Japan, from Israel. Last I heard, we have over 60, but I'm not sure that they're all at Cobo. There was a second world championship. We got so large that we had to divide it, and it was in Houston last week.
That's something. That says it's really burgeoning. Is there a theme to this year's competition? Do the robots all have one common task they have to perform?
Yes, and the theme is deep space. So it's all about space and tying it into the science of space. And so every field is themed that way, from our youngest to our oldest. And in fact, if you were to come on Friday, you would see that 1,500 Detroit kids that are on FIRST Robotics teams will be here visiting. and so will the lieutenant governor.
All right. And as you said, it's free, open to everybody to come on down. And it certainly seems like there's a lot of fun and energy attached with this competition.
You have to see this to believe it. The really cool thing about FIRST Robotics is that the kids don't just go in a corner and build the robot on their own. Every single company lends us engineers, and they work together, and it's a win-win. For the companies, it's that they get first crack at our kids early, and for the kids, it's that they get into the brains and get to see what a career looks like in engineering.
So here you've got these professional mentors working with students, and it's all happening at the FIRST Robotics World Championship. Back to Detroit for a second year. Gail Alpert is president of FIRST in Michigan. Best of luck hosting the world.
And thank you so much. We'd love to see everybody come.
Consumers Energy is a corporate sponsor of the FIRST Championship. Patty Poppe is president and CEO of Consumers Energy, and she is chair of the host committee. So, Patty, with 42,000-some people coming into Detroit, you're the one saying welcome.
Oh, you bet. And we could not be more excited about highlighting the talent of these young people from across the world right here in the home of FIRST Robotics of Michigan.
You know, I've got to imagine Consumers Energy gets a lot of requests, and you personally, for support and for funding. Why was the FIRST Robotics Championship something that got a yes?
Well, it's really the FIRST Robotics mission, which is to give access to young people to a fun way to learn about STEM careers. They have absolutely cracked the code on how to make science, technology, engineering, math, fun and exciting in an athletic-like environment. And as Dean Kamen, the founder of FIRST Robotics, always says, it's the only sport where everyone can go pro.
Interesting, because certainly you must be looking at these students on all of these robotics teams. And what do you see in them that could make them employees of the future?
These kids finish their high school experience with career-ready skills. They are able to design parts in CAD. They can make them on the machining tools and water jets and high-tech equipment. They then can build them and turn them into something that delivers an outcome. Those are skills that can go to work today. They can go on to a trade school, or they can go on to engineering and computer science and IT careers. It's really like a 3D video game, and it is full use of these kids' talents.
And business skills, right? Teamwork and business skills, which could really make them valuable in any job.
You bet. You know, I watched it with my own daughters who are on their high school robotics team, and they're both, by the way, graduating from engineering school this year. They learned and were part of a team for the first time in their lives because they actually weren't that good at sports. I'm sorry, that's going to be on the airwaves, but they weren't that good at sports. And so to be on a team like this changed their lives and gave them the opportunity to win and lose alongside coworkers. And that's an important skill that we need in our offices.
And starting early, because I understand these robotics teams, FIRST of Michigan wants to see them starting from preschool all the way up.
That's right. These are life-preparing skills. This is a path to prosperity, and so I would just encourage this, all your listeners, if they have a young person in their life, they should bring them down to Detroit, take a look at what is happening, how much fun it can be to solve the biggest problems and to be part of something so special as FIRST Robotics, to see it firsthand. This is not a science fair. This is not like where we think of, you know, kind of clip charts and poster boards and people talking. This is an athletic-like environment. Bring your families, bring your young people in your life down to Detroit and show them what is possible.
What is the atmosphere like inside Cobo or at Ford Field?
Yeah, as you mentioned, there's going to be 42,000 people in stadium stands. People have never seen Cobo set up like this. There will be six competition-sized fields. Each of these fields is like the size of a high school basketball court, and each of them will be filled with stands and mascots and music and scoreboards. It is definitely like the Final Four for robots. It is the world championship. It's so exciting. Come prepared to have a great time.
And you don't need a high GPA to come.
No, you don't. No, you don't. And that's what busts the myth that you have to be super smart to be on one of these teams. You just have to be motivated, and you can be taught. The students on these teams are working alongside working engineers and computer scientists, so they're getting apprenticed, if you will, while they're in high school. And I'll also offer that all of the activities this weekend are free, so anyone can come. It truly is going to be a family experience, and everyone should come and see what the future looks like and to know that our future is well prepared here in Michigan with more high school robotics teams than any other state in the country.
Kind of drilling down into that point, Patty, how much does this help keep the talent in Michigan? If I'm a student and I'm working alongside, say, some of your professionals and your engineers, what does that do to help keep these kids in Michigan?
That's exactly what it does. It makes a bond between a young person and their mentor, their teacher. They're coming back to these companies. They are motivated and realize that they can have exciting, fulfilling careers right here at home. That's why Consumers Energy is so interested in supporting this enterprise and FIRST Robotics, not because all of these students will come to Consumers, but we want all of these students to come to Michigan. We're actually hosting a Choose Michigan competition to careers fair specifically for Michigan companies to expose their future jobs and opportunities to the young people who are on the field competing. Now, how about that? High schoolers being recruited for permanent positions in big Michigan companies. We're definitely rolling out the welcome mat to the best and brightest from around the world, and we hope that that helps our Michigan customers and companies grow.
The FIRST Championship is free and open to everybody. This global championship happening the next 4 days at Cobo Center and Ford Field in Detroit. All the details, you can find them at firstchampionship.org/Detroit. And we've been talking to the chair of the host committee, who happens to be the president and CEO of Consumers Energy. Patty Poppe, great talking with you. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Kalkaska is throwing a party. It is the National Trout Festival, where the motto is, it's fish o'clock somewhere. Debbie Balloday is with us now from Kalkaska. And Debbie, my mom and dad had a little cottage near Kalkaska in the early 70s, and I remember being so impressed with that great big proud trout statue on Cedar Street. So this town takes trout seriously.
Yes, we do. That trout fountain has been there since 1966, and we have taken the time and expense to have it refurbished a couple of times to keep it looking sparkling, and kind of helps draw in the tourists, and they, you know, stop and take the pictures there when they're on Main Street.
Absolutely. So give us a little history. When did the town begin this festival to celebrate trout, and why?
Well, it started in the 30s, and it was a way for from the Chamber of Commerce, a way to hopefully draw some folks in, celebrate all of the beautiful streams and rivers and lakes that we have here that are just chock full of trout, and just celebrate the area. And it's been celebrated with the exception of 2 years during World War II. So that's why we don't put annual in the name. It's just this year is the 83rd National Trout Festival.
That is impressive. That's some serious staying power there. So I've got to figure some of the events have to do with trout. Do you have fishing competitions?
We do. On Saturday, we have a youth fishing competition that takes place. It's out on M66, which is a private property, but these folks, out of the goodness of their hearts, has let us use their pond for a number of years now. And we go in and stock it with 1,000 trout, and 100 of them are tagged. And anytime a kid gets one of the tagged fish, they win a wonderful prize. And then we have two special fish that are a little bit bigger than the other ones, and they have a special tag on them. And that's a giant prize. That's a huge gift package worth probably $200.
And tell us about this year's Grand Marshal.
Well, there's a special story connected to this year's Grand Marshal. His name is Fred Perrin. And Fred was a junior at high school here at Kalkaska High School, 1962. And he was asked by some members of the Chamber of Commerce, if we had a big memorial fountain that we put in downtown, what do you think it should look like? And he sketched it out. And from there, it went to a design architect, I believe, is who it went to in Traverse City. And they came up with a rendering, and then there were two gentlemen who created the mold for it, and then it was actually cast. So Fred somehow kind of got jumped over by history, and there was a plaque down at the Trout Fountain that's been there for years, and it lists all of those people, the people who are part of the Chamber of Commerce Board and the architect company in Traverse City, or the design company in Traverse City, and all of these people, but Fred's name was never mentioned. And the trial board became aware of this year when his son launched a personal campaign to get his dad the recognition that he deserved. And when we heard the story, of course, we jumped right on board with it. We're like, holy smokes, we've got to do right by this gentleman.
Very good. So you're circling around and giving credit where it's due for that big trout fountain.
So when we have our opening ceremony Thursday evening, we are installing and dedicating a plaque that names Fred as the original sketch artist designer of the trout fountain, and also that he was being honored this year as our grand marshal. And he graciously agreed to design our logo for this year. So that beautiful It's Fish O'Clock Somewhere logo that has his name right across the front and a little pool of water under the clock. And so we wanted everybody to know that he was the artist for that and giving him the credit that he deserved.
That's fantastic. Debbie, what's your favorite memory through the years from this festival?
Well, when I was quite young, I want to say I was about 5, I won one of those wonderful fishing pole prizes from the trout pond for the kids fishing. And then, of course, as a teenager, you have, you know, hanging out with all your friends, going on the tilt-a-whirl and staying out late and all those wonderful things. Since I've become actively involved the last few years as part of with the director, I just really like watching the folks. I've been a people watcher anyhow, but it's just a lot of fun to sit back and watch the folks have fun.
I have to ask you, do you fish now?
I do not. I haven't fished since I was a little kid. I don't know that I actually could bait the hook myself.
Well, everybody is welcome to come to Kalkaska April 25th to the 28th, and you can go to nationaltroutfestival.com and get all the details and the schedule. Debbie, thank you so much for talking with us, and have a great time celebrating the trout.
Thank you so much. And everybody, like you said, everybody is welcome. We can't wait to see everybody. It's going to be a great weekend.
Still to come, Alma College will no longer require SAT or ACT scores from applicants.
There are students who are now specifically just looking at test optional institutions. So we are now a part of that shorter list.
In 10 minutes, we'll talk about why more colleges are becoming test optional in their admissions. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is Wednesday, and that means it's time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. On this eve of the 5th anniversary of the Flint water disaster, one might ask, just how do you record and preserve details from such a catastrophic event like this for perpetuity? Well, who better to ask than our partner at the Michigan History Center, State Archivist Mark Harvey, who literally does this for his job. Welcome back, Mark.
Thank you.
Mark, as an archivist, how do you approach such a massive event as the Flint water disaster when you think about recording and preserving things from this event for people to study for generations beyond?
We have lots of processes to deal with actual weather emergencies. So if there was a tornado or a flood and there were records or artifacts damaged, we have all those emergency response procedures in place. But we don't necessarily have a process for when an event like the Flint water crisis happens. So initially, for myself, I was reading the paper and got sort of caught up in the story of it. And it's like when I talked to my son at baseball practice, like, don't watch the game, be part of the game. So after a while, you know, we kick into archivist or curator mode and start thinking about the importance of documenting what's going on, you know, right before our eyes. You know, events are still occurring. The need is to document it. So when we think about history, it's really a present occupation. So that's how we looked at Flint water, not right at the onset of it, but within the first 6 to 12 months, we quickly realized we had to document this from a number of fronts.
So what has the Michigan History Center been able to document or preserve so far?
The History Center's documented a lot of artifacts that cover things like water distribution points, artifacts like water bottle kits, ephemera, and t-shirts, all these different components of the state's response to that crisis, whether it's from Department of Environmental Quality or Department of Health and Human Services. We also went to Dr. Mona herself and asked for some artifacts to represent her groundbreaking work in the crisis. There's one of her lab coats and a stethoscope, and a very moving component is a chandelier made by kids in the pediatric unit at the Hurley Medical Center. So it's a multicolored chandelier made out of old plastic water bottles.
As you're sitting and kind of realizing we need to grab things, we need to preserve things, how do you decide what is worth preserving and archiving?
The thing that we look at the most is what is the public going to want or need or should have access to in the future. I phrase it, maybe someone else has phrased this before I have, but I call it the democracy of information. So we see our role as the gatekeepers of information the public needs or wants or should have. So that's one lens we look at it through. And then the other is that interpretive lens. So our other role is to preserve those stories that have occurred in Michigan so that we can reinterpret them at some later date to be determined so that people don't forget, especially with an event like the Flint water crisis.
Oral history certainly became a very, very key part of preserving the history of Detroit's 1967 rebellion. In fact, they even trained, you know, squadrons of volunteers to take these oral histories. Is that something that has been done or you're considering doing, collecting oral histories about the Flint water disaster?
Both. So the Flint Public Library worked with NPR's program, StoryCorps, and they did a project in 2015 and then renewed it in 2016 and did a lot of oral histories through that project. There's other local groups that have done other recording projects around the Flint water crisis. We'd like to. It's sort of that delicate balance of, okay, many people thought the state helped exacerbate or created this problem, so we're a state institution. There's a real trust factor going into a local community and saying, hey, let us record the story that many feel like the state helped or create on its own. And I think that goes with any collecting that we do, and it's something they never train you for in any grad school courses, that human element of trust in communication. So first I have to convince you that your history is important enough to save, which is, for a lot of people, even though it is a big hurdle. And then I have to get you to trust me with your story. That's an even bigger hurdle. And when you're coming from a state agency, I think most people would probably trend towards not trusting. So that's one. I think we've done a good job at that. But that's something that I always keep in front of mind, is that I need to earn someone's trust to preserve and share their story, and then we take it from there.
I suspect that's what could keep an archivist like you up at night, kind of thinking about how to make this all work.
Yes. Yeah. So I think that with the Flint water crisis, one of the early stories that came out was that they didn't have accurate assessor records to even determine who had lead service pipes to their house, and some of them were penciled written. I actually reached out immediately, because we don't just collect stories. We can help people preserve their information. So we reached out to the local agency to see if we could help, and I think it was too much at the time for us to try to come in and help them sort those records out, which they did on their own, but that was one of those things that, oh, I wish we could have helped them. Because that, again, is that trust-building part of this project, where if we could build trust, then we could help them preserve that record. But also just individuals. There must be thousands of people that have a story about this crisis and how they were affected. No amount of oral histories are going to cover all those stories.
So when you think of the pieces and artifacts that you've collected so far, what's the one that really stands out most to you?
A couple things. A lot of the documents, the archival stuff, is still under litigation hold. So we don't have access to a lot of those records that traditionally an archivist would go after. We do, early on, I did reach out and contact Mark Edwards and their staff at Virginia Tech. But what they've done is really a good job of publishing everything that they've done, both working papers and final reports. So we've essentially just crawled their website and copied materials off. But those are important, because that's a university from another state. There's no guarantee that flintwaterstudy.org is going to be there indefinitely.
That website that they created.
Right. I mean, I think we make assumptions that that's just going to be there. So we took it upon ourselves to crawl that site with their permission. That's really important. And then from the artifact side, the Michigan History Museum, which is part of the center, actually through a curator on staff who lives in Flint, you know, is part of the community, and knew former Mayor Dane Walling, who was able to collect a section of his lead service line and his refrigerator water filter as part of the collection. So we actually have a piece of one of the pipes.
So if you were to fast forward, let's say, a century into the future, what do you hope Michiganders a century from now would glean from the preservation efforts that the Michigan History Center is doing?
I hope they'd be able to see the whole picture, whether that's from the researchers at Virginia Tech or the red flags thrown up by the medical community led by Dr. Mona, or the efforts or the lack thereof of different agencies that had a part in this crisis, you know, from state on down to local to private companies. So we're trying to give as wide a focus as possible. We're not trying to predetermine what people think, just give them all the ingredients to look at what happened and make their own judgment.
Any plans to do with something with what you've collected, perhaps an exhibition?
Yeah, whenever we collect, interpretation is always part of that. And so when it comes to archival material, our intention is to preserve it and make it available to the public. In this case, again, because the litigation holds and because flintwaterstudy.org is already online, we'll do it in some way. I'm not 100% sure how. But then on the museum side, I'm sure at some point we have these incredible artifacts that we can interpret and tell the story, and we will do that at some point.
Mark Harvey, State Archivist with the Michigan History Center, thank you so much for sharing your inside knowledge on how you go about archiving such a major event as the Flint water crisis. Thanks so much, Mark.
Thank you.
More and more colleges are going test optional. That's where submitting ACT or SAT scores for admission is up to the applicant. Alma College in mid-Michigan has just joined that list. Beginning with the 2020 incoming class, the private liberal arts college will be test optional. Amanda Slensky is vice president of admissions at Alma. Why did Alma decide to change the standardized test requirement?
So we really have been having this discussion around campus for about a year. And as a small institution where we really look at each individual student as an individual and really think as them as someone who has many multifacets that we want to learn about, we wanted to mirror that in the admissions process as well. So we know that a test score may not be the ideal thing for a student to utilize to show their ability to be successful in college. So we want to give students options. So students will be able to do the traditional pathway, but they will also be able to choose to do a test optional pathway where they'll do an interview with someone in the academic sector of our campus to be able to be admitted through that pathway without their test scores.
Will there be a GPA minimum for an applicant who wants to skip the SAT or ACT?
There will be. So students who decide to go test optional will need to have a 3.0 grade point average in high school, or they can have a 2.75 grade point average of their core coursework. So things like math, history, foreign language, English, courses like that. Either way would be acceptable.
So for the school, Amanda, who are the students who have not traditionally thought of Alma when they're making up their wish list that you hope might now apply because you'll be test optional?
So one of the things that we have seen as an institution is we tend to have really good regional recognition all around the state of Michigan, but not as much out of state. So one of the things that we're hoping as we make this move is there are students who are now specifically just looking at test optional institutions. So we are now a part of that shorter list. So especially out of state students who are looking for test optional institutions, we are now going to be a part of that list in their exploration.
I know the U.S. News and World Report college rankings list, we checked it out, and Alma's got the 64% admissions acceptance rate, an 80% retention rate, and a four-year graduation rate of 56%. That was the 2017 rating. Do you think going test optional will affect those metrics?
Way to do some great research on Alma. So we do not think that it'll impact it. So one of the things that we noticed as an institution is we did not find a correlation between retention of our students and then their ultimate graduation and their test scores. So we actually stopped utilizing ACT and SAT as a predictor for a student's success on our campus in terms of retention and ultimate graduation about a year ago. And so this aligns with that. So we will continue to do our diligence of seeing how successful students are and what leading indicators are available to us to see whether or not they'll be successful. But as of all of our data that we have now, this is not a great indicator for us. High school grade point average is, and so that's why that is staying. And then the students' connection on campus is another great indicator. So being involved in a campus organization, finding their fit on our campus, having an on-campus employment opportunity, things of that nature are better indicators for us for ultimate success.
Feeling like you're part of the community.
Exactly, 100%.
As more colleges go test optional with admissions, there seems to be some debate about what it could mean. Inside Higher Ed, a report on a study showing kids who got into college without submitting test scores did just fine. And then, on the other hand, the not-for-profit group College Board says the best predictors of college success are SAT scores combined with high school grades. But we must note, the College Board owns, develops, and publishes the SAT. As an admissions officer, how confident are you don't need standardized test results to figure out who will do well at Alma?
I think that every student is different. So for some students, the standardized test score is a good indicator for them of showing what they've achieved in high school and their ability to be successful in college. But that is not the case for all students. So standardized tests are really a one-size-fits-all type of opportunity, and that doesn't work for all students. And so that is why I'm a big fan of what a lot of colleges, like what we are doing, are now offering different pathways for students. So if a student determines that the standardized test is not a good indicator for them, they have another pathway to not have a barrier to entry going into college and to be able to have a different way to be evaluated throughout the admissions process.
The organization Fair Test calls itself the National Center for Fair and Open Testing, and their website is claiming more than 1,000 four-year colleges and universities do not use the ACT or the SAT to admit a good number of their students. Some schools are not traditional four-year universities, but it does list some schools in Michigan that have gone test optional to some degree, Kalamazoo College and Ferris State among them. Are you feeling like this trend is going to grow?
I really do. And you've seen that even over this last year. So over the last year, a number of schools have made this decision. And some of it is because there's more and more data on a regular basis that is giving schools more information as they're making this decision. So for example, for us, we realized that it was not a good indicator for retention for our students. We also were able to look at the data that's been gathered by a number of institutions over the last couple of decades that shows that students who come in through a test optional pathway are just as successful as students who submit a test score. And there's more and more information that's available to schools, so we're able to make more informed decisions as we're thinking about our admissions processes.
Is there also in this policy, is this a purposeful way to make your campus more diverse?
So we do have goals for our institution to where we become a more diverse institution and to have a more diverse campus community. We've been very successful in meeting those goals, but we keep moving the goal and moving that goal post so that we can become even more diverse. And we want our campus to be a representation of what the greater world and the greater community around us is in terms of that diversity. And so we always strive to bring a more diverse incoming class and to have a more diverse student body on our campus. It has been shown through the data that I mentioned that the SAT and the ACT, although not intentional, can be disadvantageous to students, minority students, and underrepresented students have to overcome cultural barriers as they're taking that exam. And our hope is that we start to remove some of those barriers for those students as we have this pathway for them to go test optional if they so choose.
Well, case in point, I mean, think how expensive SAT an ACT test prep can be, and there are families that can afford that, and their kids have an advantage.
Exactly. And students that are coming from a higher socioeconomic status are able to take the exam more than once. They're able to do that test prep multiple times. The state of Michigan provides a cost-free SAT exam for all high school students. So all students are able to take it once, but those testing retakes can really put a financial burden on families.
So this will begin with the incoming class of 2020. How do you think in 10 years, if you and I are talking about this, how will it be? What will we be saying about this new policy?
I hope that what we say 10 years from now is that we were able to align our admissions process with how we really strive to treat every student on our campus. We are looking at students from the very first day they interact with Alma as individuals, and we make sure that our processes do not stand in the way of them being successful on campus and beyond. So I hope 10 years from now we have a long history of many students who have gone through both this process and our traditional process and are successful out in the world, and we continue to grow our campus community in that same way.
Amanda Selensky is Vice President of Admissions at Alma College. Great talking with you. Thank you so very much.
You too. Thank you so much.
A reminder and an invitation. Stateside is going on the road again. And this time, we're heading to the Arab American National Museum on Michigan Avenue in Dearborn. So excited to see it, and we would love to see you in our audience. It's Thursday, May 2nd, 7 p.m., totally free. Just register by going to michiganradio.org. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Bob Skahn. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Today's contributors are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Sarah Leeson, Bella Isaacs, and Katie Raymond. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.